for.
How can we look beyond GDP and develop new metrics that balance growth with human flourishing and environmental well-being? How can we be more engaged global citizens? In this age of AI, what does it really mean to be human? And how are our technologies transforming us? Daniel Susskind is a research professor in economics at King's College London and a senior research associate at the Institute for Ethics in AI at Oxford University. He's the author of A World Without Work and co-author of the best-selling The Future of the Professions. Previously, he worked in various roles in the British government, in the Prime Minister's Strategy Unit, in the Policy Unit in 10 Downing Street, and in the Cabinet Office. His latest book is Growth: A Reckoning.
Daniel Susskind, welcome to the Creative Process and One Planet podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
So I've been so enjoying Growth: A Reckoning, and it was just, it's not something that I learned in school, just this whole historical context of what is growth and GDP. And these concepts were relatively recently introduced, as you outline in your book, up until the Cold War. And so the 1950s, I guess almost no economist was focusing on economic growth in the way that we do now. So just to give us a bit of a background on growth, how did the emphasis on GDP emerge, and how did it maybe inspire you to write Growth: A Reckoning?
The history of growth is fascinating. One of the things that's so interesting about it is how new the idea is. Now, this idea that we ought to pursue economic growth sits at the center of our common life together. Now, the fate of politicians and policymakers rises or falls depending upon whether or not that measure, GDP, gross domestic product, goes up or down. And yet the amazing thing is, before the 1950s, almost nobody, no economists, no policymakers, no politicians, was talking about the idea of economic growth. And then what's interesting is that even if they had, in a sort of moment of inspiration, decided that they wanted to pursue growth, there would have been no way to do it. Before the 1950s, there was really no reliable way to know how big the economy was, whether it was growing, and if it was growing by how much. Where growth comes from, it's actually a product of war more than anything else. In the 1940s, the British government are at war, and a basic question when you're waging war is, how much of the economy can you slice up and dedicate to the war effort, and how much do you have to keep behind for civilian citizen needs? And the British government asked that question, but they couldn't answer it because there wasn't a measure of how big the British economy really was. And so the great British economist John Maynard Keynes, alongside American Simon Kuznets, developed what became known, actually not until the 1990s, as GDP. But GDP, of course, is just a static snapshot of how big the economy is at a particular moment in time. What put growth on the map, so this sort of relentless pursuit of GDP, was not the Second World War, but the Cold War. What's interesting about the Cold War, of course, is that there are no traditional measures of who's winning. Territory won and lost, soldiers killed, equipment destroyed, and so on. What happens is the size of the economies of the United States and of the Soviet Union become a kind of proxy measure of who is winning that Cold War, in part because the view is that the country with a larger economy will be able to fund a larger military in the event there's ever sort of mad decision is taken to turn this Cold War into a hot one. But it was also a battle of ideas between a market-based economy in the United States and a planned economy in the Soviet Union. And these GDP figures gave a sense of who was winning that battle of ideas. And of course, the great fear at the start of the Cold War was that the numbers appeared to suggest that actually the Soviet Union was winning. So the Cold War ushers in this kind of period of growthmanship where the pursuit of an ever larger economy is the thing that isn't kind of indicative of who's winning that war. Now, what then happens is the 20th century, it turns out the growth is associated with almost every measure of human flourishing. And so even when the demands of war fall away, the pursuit of growth remains. So it kind of gets this sort of pole position it has today in society almost by accident.
Yes, you also kind of hint there, it almost measures all the metrics for human flourishing, but there are a lot of things that it doesn't measure accurately to a quality of life. But perhaps Now would be a good time to share a passage from Growth and Reckoning, which touches upon some of those other areas.
Yeah, what I'd love to do is read the last paragraph of the book, actually, because I think the book is fundamentally an optimistic book. And I think this final note of optimism, the book really captures that. So I'll begin reading. This influence over the future is a great responsibility. It is also ironic. In centuries to come, people will doubtlessly view us as backward in much the same way that we today think of Stone Age hunter-gatherers. And yet, their fate is in our primitive hands. Just as the flap of the proverbial butterfly's wings in a Brazilian forest might set off a tornado in the cornfields of Texas, the actions that we take today will ripple through time and shape the lives of trillions of unborn people that we will never meet or know. But I do not believe we should be held hostage by that immense future. Rather, it should encourage us to look forwards with a sense of excitement and wonder at what we might accomplish, not only for our children and their children, but for those in generations to come. For 300,000 years, humankind looked out on the future, and what they saw must have seemed inescapably bleak, a relentless, unforgiving struggle for subsistence. Modern economic growth has changed that. In the words of Nietzsche, noted at the beginning of this book, "The sea, our sea, lies open again. Maybe there has never been such an open sea. This is the beginning of human history, if we choose."
I like that invitation to, you know, consider our futures and take it in our own hands. And it's really a call to action. And toward the third section of the book, how can we be more engaged global citizens? How can we improve these metrics to imagine new futures that is based not just on those limitations of GDP? How do we develop those other metrics? So how do you propose, and I know it's not all about propositions, of course, you have the history of growth, but how do you propose we develop new metrics to capture those aspects of social value that is being overlooked? The health, the happiness, the informal care work, and these things.
So you're exactly right. I mean, the book is a book of two halves. The first part of the book is a sort of intellectual history of the idea of growth, why we didn't have it for 300,000 years, why it suddenly begins just 200 odd years ago, how little we know about the idea of growth, despite its immense importance, and the extraordinary promise of growth that it's associated with almost every measure of human flourishing, as we were saying before, but also the immense price of growth as well, that it's associated with many of the great challenges that we face too. The second half of the book turns to what we should do about what I call the growth dilemma, this tension between the extraordinary promise of growth and the immense price of growth, this feeling of being wrenched in two directions at the same time. It's as if we want more growth desperately, but it feels like we need less and less of it. And so, you know, a natural starting point is to think about how we measure growth. And as we're saying, the GDP measure is the traditional way in which we measure the size of the economy and in turn whether the economy is growing or shrinking. There's two big problems with the GDP measure. One are the sort of technical limitations of GDP, that it actually does quite a bad job measuring the amount of economic activity that takes place in the market, in an economy. For instance, there are many things that are tremendously valuable but don't come with a price tag attached, things like a search engine or our email. And because it doesn't have a price attached, these things don't appear in the traditional GDP statistics. There's also lots of things that, while they do appear and they do have a price, their quality changes very dramatically over time, and we're very bad at capturing those quality improvements. So, you know, an iPhone today might have a similar price to an iPhone, say, 5 years ago, but it's in so many different dimensions dramatically improved in terms of quality. So there's a whole bundle of sort of technical limitations with the GDP measure. But then there's also, and you can trace these disagreements right from the beginning of the creation of the GDP measure in the 40s, there's also a set of worries about the sort of moral limits of the GDP measure. That is also a bad sort of moral measure of what matters. There are many socially valuable things that we don't include in the GDP statistics, so the health of the environment, the level of inequality. But there are also many things which are not socially valuable that we do include. In the book, I trace out debates and disagreements about things like the economic value of prostitution and drugs and black markets and crime and so on. These are things which appear in certain technical calculations of the amount of activity that's taking place in the economy. But from a social point of view, it's not obvious that those are particularly valuable activities that we do want to include. And so there is a very strong intellectual current of thought that says, look, the way to deal with this issue, Daniel, that you're talking about, this tension between the promise and the price of growth, is to try and somehow capture the value of those other things that we do care about and bundle them into a sort of more perfect GDP statistic. So to value the state of the environment and try and bundle that into a GDP calculation, or to value the level of inequality in society and bundle that in, rather than pursue the sort of morally flawed GDP measure we pursue today, we ought to instead pursue this morally enriched GDP measure, which better reflects what we really value and care about as a society. And that is the direction in which lots of people are traveling today. The argument I make in the book is that actually that's probably a mistake, that these questions about what we really value, if not the pursuit of growth, things like the environment, inequality, the health of particular local places and communities, the functioning of our politics or the availability of good, you know, all of these things, the question of what things we value, if not growth, and in turn, the question of how much we ought to value those things relative to one another, these are fundamental moral questions about what we care about as a society. And the place to answer those moral questions is not, in my view, in treasuries and central government statistical offices. It's not for technocrats and economists and statisticians to answer these questions, as they're trying to do today, but it's for citizens, it's for politics. And so a big theme of the book is about trying to push down some of these difficult moral questions about what we care about as a society and how much we care about those things relative to one another, to push them down to new kinds of political institutions, citizens' assemblies, citizens' panels, citizens' juries that can engage with these difficult trade-offs and debates, rather than leaving them to, as we do today, economists and statisticians.
Yes, I think that the average person would like to find those statistics in one area, or just, now I know the GDP, but just next to it, so that we can have it at our fingertips more, because we're drowning in the amount of data that's being stored is doubling every 2 years. So it's just about having a place we can find it. I would like to have it all in one place.
That idea is something I'm very, very sympathetic to. The idea of almost like a dashboard, where we have a GDP measure, which we recognize as being flawed and limited and partial. But alongside it, we have other measures of things that we value and care about. Measures that are chosen not by economists and technocrats and bureaucrats and so on, but by citizens who deliberate on what sorts of things they want their society to care about and value and measure. That's something that I think is important, that rather than bundle all of these things into a GDP figure where it's very opaque and unclear how it's been calculated, to instead very clearly set out what these things are that we care about, how we're measuring them, and to have transparency about those things.
And we should say that you have practical knowledge. You've worked in Downing Street. And so you've had these conversations, you know, about navigating the societal trade-offs. And you know, emphasize the importance of really understanding the societal trade-offs when we're pursuing that growth. So how do you propose we navigate those trade-offs, particularly with regard to those things you mentioned, the environment, equality, globalization, you know, without compromising the long-term sustainability?
So the kind of practical side is a kind of running theme in all of my work, that I like to answer the question, what should we actually do about it? Because as many people have noted, it's far easier to write about the problems that we face and far harder to come up with tractable solutions to those problems. What do I think we should do? I think the starting point, and it might sound counterintuitive given what I said about this growth dilemma and the immense price of growth, but my starting point is that we desperately need more growth. A big part of the book is about how we do that and how we often create trouble for ourselves in our misunderstandings about how growth actually works. I think large parts of the environmental movement and the degrowth movement in particular have misunderstood how growth actually works. And I set out in the book how little we know about economic growth, what it tells us, and how we can use that to get more economic growth. But if we were to only pursue more economic growth, then we would be committing the same mistake as we have in the past, relentlessly pursuing more growth, but neglecting the extraordinary price of doing so. And so what I also do in the book is explain how we ought to try and change the nature of that growth as well. You know, there's sometimes a sense in which when politicians and policymakers talk about economic growth, it's as if they are train drivers sitting in a train and they can sort of pull back on a lever and slow down or push forward on a lever and go faster. But their direction of economic travel is fixed by the rails that are set down in front of them. And I think that metaphor is wrong. A far better metaphor for thinking about the challenge is not a locomotive metaphor, but it's a nautical one. We should imagine that politicians and policymakers are like sailors on a boat, and they can put up the sails and go faster or pull them down and go slower, but they can also choose whatever direction they want on the open sea. It's one of the reasons I like that Nietzsche quotation at the end of the book so much, because it has this sea metaphor. We ought to try and choose both the quantity of growth that we enjoy in society, but also the kind of direction of growth, the quality, the nature of that growth as well. And so what I try and do is set out how we can have not simply more growth, but also growth that is respectful of place, that it doesn't cause as much damage to the environment, that it doesn't lead to as large inequalities in society, that it doesn't disrupt politics, that it doesn't undermine the availability of good work. And so part of the book is then about how we pursue a different type of growth as well. Part of the closing part of the book is also, what do we do if we have to choose? What do we do if there really is a trade-off between growth and these other things that we care about? And that's where I think politics becomes very important, that these trade-offs, if we want to resolve them in legitimate ways, is in politics. We can catch a glimpse today of how, for certain trade-offs, we're not doing a good enough job. I think on something like climate change, there is at the moment a feeling, you know, I happen to believe that the pursuit of net zero and the pursuit of a greener type of growth is the right path for us to take. But that path comes at an economic cost. There are trade-offs involved. The growing discontent about the price that certain people and certain industries are paying for this green transition. We have to bring those people along on this alternative economic direction. And at the moment, we're not doing that. You can see the discontent, not simply in the US, but in the politics across Europe, that we're not doing a good enough job of engaging people in some of the difficult trade-offs that we face, in this case, with respect to the environment. But I think you can see it with respect to other challenges as well.
Indeed. And that's been the criticism as well in lots of sectors, but in the global south, when countries are just getting their growth and to be told by countries that have already had their growth for, you know, a century fueled by fossil fuels, then telling those in the global south to not use oil, gas and coal like we've been doing seems unfair unless we support them in their renewable energy transition. So maybe degrowth works for certain countries within Europe, or I should say, because you identify different tiers of degrowth. Yes. I understand that you advocate for weak degrowth. So perhaps, yes, you could just expand upon that, because I do believe in a certain level of degrowth as you define weak degrowth.
Yeah. So the degrowth movement began a few decades ago as a relatively obscure idea that was mainly discussed among a small group of ecologically minded academics. But it's become pretty popular now. Now, you have politicians like Caroline Lucas in the UK, environmentalists like David Attenborough, activists like Greta Thunberg, all appealing in different ways to the idea of degrowth. Part of the difficulty, though, is that when you actually look at what is meant by degrowth, it is extraordinarily confusing. There's a huge amount of disagreement. And part of what I'm trying to do in the book is, as an exercise, try and tease out exactly what it is that the degrowth movement is really after. And what you get is a kind of spectrum. At one end of the extreme is a very strong degrowth, which says we ought to either not simply press pause on economic growth, but even go into reverse, shrink certain economies around the world. And in my view, that sort of degrowth would be one of the greatest acts of self-harm that humankind could inflict upon itself. There is, though, the other end of the spectrum, and this is where I sit, where it's not about pursuing less growth or no growth, but it's about, when we think about those trade-offs between growth and the climate, or growth and inequality, or whatever it might be, you recognize that there might be a price to be paid in terms of growth. And you say that that is a price worth paying, that you demote growth in the hierarchy of things that we collectively care about as a society. And I think there is merit in that. I think growth has sat at the center of our political and social lives for so long that it has a sort of primacy and importance that has led to a neglect of those other things that we might value and care about. Part of the reason for optimism is that I see this as an opportunity for moral renewal, to pay more attention to the other valuable ends that we might have neglected until now through our very dogmatic focus on growth.
Yes, I'm a very optimistic person, I think, too. But when I think of growth, sometimes I reflect on that metaphor of like cancer. You can't have unlimited, yes, growth. The cancer ends up killing the things, yeah, it's feeding off of. But also, extreme degrowth is like, you know, starving, yeah, the patients.
There is a slogan associated with the degrowth movement, which is that you cannot have infinite growth on a finite planet, which is sort of a similar idea. And the argument I make in the book is that that is just wrong, that you can have infinite growth on a finite planet. For many economists, it's not a particularly radical view, but I think for many people, it's a counterintuitive idea that you can have infinite growth on a finite planet. I think what often happens when people think about growth is that they have a very old-fashioned conception of growth in their mind. And that idea of a finite planet, I think, captures it quite well. It's a view that what matters in the world in thinking about growth is the sort of things that we can see and touch. Growth comes from using more and more of our finite resources. But that isn't where growth comes from. Growth doesn't come from the world of finite resources. It comes from the world of ideas, by discovering new ideas about how to make use of those finite resources. And whereas it's true those finite resources are finite, there's only so many acres of land that can be tilled, there's only so much raw material that can be used in production, the world of ideas is unimaginably vast, as good as infinite. And so when the degrowth movement points to the sort of limits of our material world as the kind of constraint that matters in thinking about growth, I think that's wrong. There are constraints on economic growth, but they don't come from the fact that our planet is finite. It comes from other places. So part of what I'm doing in the book is to say that I think the degrowth movement is wrong in its understanding of how growth works. And once you recognize it's wrong, I think new possibilities emerge for how we might resolve the growth dilemma.
I thought that was very interesting that we have infinite wealth of ideas. So I like that idea that we have this potential infinite yes. resource of good ideas. But it seems at the same time, we know that we're overproducing ideas sometimes. But how many of them are good? And how do you identify the good ideas? You know, because we could also waste a lot of resources on the bad ones and the delays and in term
issues. That's right. Because one of the metaphors I like for thinking about this is picture a kitchen larder, a well-stocked kitchen larder with maybe 300 ingredients in it. There are finite ingredients in it, but there are more possible recipes for combining those ingredients than there are atoms in the universe. Exactly the same sort of logic applies when thinking about growth, but we're thinking about quite literally all the materials that we have on planet Earth. The reason I say that was because there was an economist once who told that story in a lecture, and then someone put up their hand and said, well, aren't many of those recipes for things like chicken ice cream? In other words, pretty bad recipes, exactly as you're saying, leaving aside the fact that there now is actually a chicken ice cream, which I think is a terrible, terrible idea for something to eat. What's important to remember is just that kind of unimaginable number of combinatorial possibilities that come from combining finite resources that we have just means that, yes, there are going to be some bad ideas there, but the extraordinary amount of possibility completely dwarfs those bad ideas.
The other things yes. that you write about are, you know, whether you discuss the impact of automation. Your two books, the one that you co-authored with your father and A Future yes. Without Work on the Future of the Professions, you discuss the impact of automation and suggest that technology should assist rather than replace workers. But that yeah. this technological frontier that we face is not like those other periods in the past where we would be yeah. able to necessarily create new jobs.
That's right. Yeah. The sort of running theme in all of my work since I started writing has been technology. The first book that I wrote was exactly as you say, The Future of the Professions. I co-authored it with my dad, and it was looking at the impact of technology and particularly AI on professionals, on white collar workers, on lawyers and doctors and teachers and accountants and architects and consultants and so on. And that was published in 2015. And, you know, we started working on that back in 2010. The second book I wrote was A World Without Work. And that was in January 2020, so just before the pandemic began. And that was a kind of broader look at the impact of technology and automation, not just on white-collar workers, but on the whole world of work and the sort of immense challenges that automation could pose to society. And then this new book, Growth, although it is a book about growth, more fundamentally, though, it's also a book about technological progress, because one of the key themes of the book is that what drives growth in the end is technological progress. We discover new ideas about the world. We discover new ways of making use of finite resources that we have. And another word for that is that we generate technological progress. And so one of the arguments of the book is that we have a choice. We not only have more or less growth, but we can also change the nature of growth. The same is true of our technologies too. It's the same story. We can have more technological progress and less technological progress, but we can also have different types of technological progress. We can develop technologies in society that make us more prosperous, but also don't damage the environment, don't widen inequalities in society. And so actually, deeper down, it really is a book about technology, because at the moment, I think we've got the wrong kind. And those two previous books are a kind of look at arguably the sort of wrong kind of technological progress. I worry that in decades to come, technology might have a very harmful impact on our working lives. And so in a way, this book is a kind of generalization of those ideas that I developed in those earlier books.
Yes, and I have those same concerns. I mean, obviously, with all the promise with medical breakthroughs and as well, you know, it goes hand in hand. Speaking about technologies and politics as a technology, you write about, you know, citizen engagement in political institutions and how we can be more involved, you know, with the rise of mini publics and citizen assemblies, just to let us know, because not everyone knows how to, they have these opinions, but they don't feel empowered. So how can we be more involved, you know, with our limited time every day, but how can... You know, just expand up on some of those solutions.
They're absolutely fascinating. So there's this group of institutions called mini publics. They come in lots of different flavors, but I think the one that people tend to have heard the most about are citizens' assemblies, when people come together, often elected like a jury. You know, they are chosen, and as part of their citizenship of a particular country, they are asked to fulfill this obligation and be part of this assembly. They are briefed on a particular issue by all the leading experts, the politicians, the industry specialists, and so on. And they deliberate together and they issue guidance, suggestions, policy recommendations, and so on to the government of the time. And they're on the rise around OECD countries. They're being used more and more. But what's really interesting about them is that at a distance, you might think, well, that's a nice way of, say, resolving disputes about what days your rubbish should be collected or whether or not to build an extra bench in the park. But these institutions are being used to engage with some of the hardest political questions in some of the most difficult places to ask those questions. So you see them being used in Ireland to engage in questions of abortion, in France to engage in the issue of euthanasia, in Korea to engage on the issue of nuclear policy. Lots of different countries are finding that these institutions are helpful for creating new political opportunities on very difficult policy questions. And so I think there is immense opportunity in using them more broadly to think not only about things like nuclear policy and euthanasia and abortion, but also to think about some of those big trade-offs that we were talking about before, thinking about the climate, inequality, the health of local places and communities. So that's why they appear in the book, because I think they offer a new path for resolving some of these very difficult moral questions that societies around the world are confronting at the moment.
My name is Nadia, and I'm a student studying in Northwestern University's Specialized Media Campus in Qatar. Recently during the summer, I was invited by a Bhutanese friend of mine to visit Bhutan for 2 weeks. So hearing Daniel Susskind's conversation about growth and this emphasis on GDP immediately made me think of Bhutan. Because unlike a lot of other countries, Bhutan uses gross national happiness as its main measure of development instead of GDP. Susskind talks about how GDP can neglect the social aspects of human life, these parts that do not come with monetary value that are still indicative of human quality of living, and the difficult trade-offs where countries must decide to focus on traditional economic growth or preserve stuff like the environment and culture that often struggle to coexist when economic growth is overly prioritized. Bhutan has definitely picked the latter. To preserve Bhutan's environment, all tourists not personally invited by a Bhutanese person are required to pay a daily fee, which is called the Sustainable Development Fee. And during my time in Bhutan, I remember my friend pointing at a mountain to me, the 24,840-foot mountain Ganghar Pensum, which is the highest unclimbed mountain in the world. Despite many tourists probably willing to pay a lot to say they have conquered the mountains, Ganghar Pensum is actually illegal to climb per Bhutanese laws because of the traditional beliefs from Bhutanese culture regarding these deities resting in the mountain. As Susskind mentions, we have attached importance to economic growth to the point it has become prominent as a factor of development. My friend herself is worried of the future of Bhutan with its relatively underdeveloped economy. But at the same time, Susskind says we must recognize that GDP is flawed and not indicative of every aspect of quality of living. The sustainable price of growth is an obvious issue. Susskind mentions the misconceptions of growth, how growth shouldn't be fueled through the material world but through ideas and innovation. And I think in a time where there's so much worry over our climate, Bhutan being the only carbon-negative country in the world is something hopeful and an idea and innovation that I think other countries should also try to grasp. Later on in the interview, Susskind shares how although economics nowadays can seem focused on mathematics, economics used to be a literary tradition. To Susskind, the most important lesson for his student is that they actually understand the core intuitive ideas behind mathematical equations and that they can see these notations as language. It's inspirational to hear of someone like Susskind who uses his storytelling to bring a new perspective of economics so different from what we are used to, an economics that ties into the values of sustainability, equality, and culture. It's important to remember that at the end of the day, economics is focused on the decision-making of society in all human aspects, not just money. Now back to the interview.
Yes, indeed. And we see the rise of populism and we see so many things. So it's hard to take it all in on a local and a global level. I'm just wondering, you know, locally, what are your reflections on how Brexit has impacted the UK economy? And, you know, are you optimistic about the prospects of the first Labour government in 14 years?
Yeah. I think Brexit is a really good example of a difficult trade-off being badly managed by our existing political institutions. The idea of resolving such a difficult question through a referendum, a sort of one-shot yes or no mechanism, where the deliberation that informs that referendum isn't the kind of careful, considered deliberation of a citizens' assembly where you've got lots of time and you're well briefed and you can discuss civilly, but instead it's done politically through political campaigns and through adversaries. It is not the way to resolve that difficult issue because, you know, fundamentally, Brexit is a trade-off between growth and other things that we might value and care about. Protecting particular industries, places, cultures and traditions. That stuff has a value, but of course so does the economy and so does growth in the economy. And Brexit was a decision to pay a price in terms of growth to protect these other things that we might care about. You know, place, community, industry, political independence and autonomy, and so on. That's a really difficult trade-off. It's a trade-off where there are legitimate grievances on all sides, and it's one that really demands careful deliberation. And it's one that seems to me would be so well suited to a citizen assembly or something like that. But instead, we did it through a referendum, and it just felt like such an inflexible, inappropriate mechanism for dealing with such a big trade-off. So I think it's really interesting that you raised that because I think it's a good example of where a citizen assembly would have worked really well to engage in a trade-off between growth and other things that people value and care about. On the Labour government, it is a tremendously difficult situation. They are forced through a variety of reasons into a position where they have to be fiscally very prudent. They have to constrain the amount they can spend. They have to increase taxes in order to pay for existing expenditure. Public services are backlogged and broken, in need of expenditure. Average real wages haven't risen for about 15 years. There's a sense the economy needs help and support from the government. When worklessness and homelessness are right, you know, there's just a whole variety of problems to which some kind of government expenditure, some kind of government action feels needed. And yet that sort of fiscal space, you know, that kind of ability to spend isn't there. Growth and the pursuit of growth has taken center stage. It's the kind of defining mission, defining purpose of the Labour government. Can they get more growth? Because growth would allow you to do all the things that you want to do. With growth comes more tax revenue, more opportunity to borrow, more opportunity to spend on all these problems that we have. And so the big question, I think you're asking, what are their prospects? Their prospects will rise and fall depending upon their ability to generate more economic growth. And I have sort of two reflections on that. One is, despite the extraordinary importance of economic growth, we know surprisingly little about it. It's one of the great mysteries of economic thought and one of the great puzzles. I do think we know enough to say the sorts of things that I've been saying, that growth is driven by ideas and technological progress. But even still, you've got to approach these things with a sort of intellectual humility. And if you're a politician, with a practical humility, that you will try and do what you can to generate growth. But there is no magic lever you can pull to generate growth in the economy. You know, if that lever existed, politicians, political leaders around the world would do it. We wouldn't have a problem of economic development because we would know what you could do to switch on the boosters of an economy. The second thing I'd say, though, alongside the kind of the caution I think the Labour government needs to have but doesn't have with respect to growth because of the little we know about it, is that what they are doing, it seems to me, is sometimes at odds with the little we do know about growth. I mean, something we've been talking about is how growth doesn't come from the kind of world we can see and touch and drop on our feet. But those are the sorts of levers that political figures in this country are pulling at the moment, building more houses, faster trains, wider roads, and so on. There's a sense that growth will come from doing big, impressive things in the material world. But my reading of the little we know about growth says it doesn't come from there, but from the world of ideas. We need to become a dynamic economy which is capable of generating ever more ideas about the world. And to do that, we need very different things. We need to spend more on research and development. We need to reform our intellectual property system. We need to get far more people into the parts of the economy that are responsible for generating ideas. We need to use the technology that we have itself. And this is one of the most radical and I think most exciting parts of the book. We need to use the technologies we have themselves to generate new ideas about the world. In the 20th century, many of our best ideas came from the heads of very smart human beings. In the 21st century, it seems to me our best ideas are not going to come from us. They're going to come from these technologies. And we can already catch a glimpse of that. I think one of the technologies I've been particularly excited by in the last few years was AlphaFold, which was a technology developed by DeepMind to solve protein folding problem in biology. So essentially, there are hundreds of thousands of proteins in our body. There are millions of them in the natural world. Understanding the 3D shape of proteins is incredibly important for understanding disease and designing effective treatment and so on. The problem is that it's incredibly difficult to figure out the 3D shape of a protein. It would take an average PhD student their entire PhD to figure out the shape of just one protein. And so we've made kind of glacial progress until AlphaFold in understanding the 3D shape of proteins. AlphaFold has basically solved the protein folding problem. It's now able to provide the 3D structures of millions of proteins, and that's going to revolutionize our ability to understand illness and develop tailored treatments. I think we're going to see more and more of this in the years to come, where we use these technologies to generate powerful new ideas about the world, improve our understanding of the world. And that is where I think growth is going to come from more and more in years to come. And again, I think that is very different from thinking that growth comes from building fast trains, building more houses. It's a very different way of looking at the sort of fundamental causes of growth.
It's interesting, the growth and then the jobs with those knowledge workers, if they are not replaced, then so it's that's the other thing, to find meaningful work, which I know that you have written about, and find meaning within our leisure and making sure.
Great. Yeah.
No, it's great. So many interesting ideas. But on that level of, you're talking about local government in the UK and citizen assemblies. How did your experience of the British governmental policy inform your views on the role of international collaboration reshaping our approach to growth?
Yeah. I think almost all of the big challenges that we face today involve some kind of international dimension. They don't respect the sort of geographical boundaries that we have built between different countries. Problems of AI, problems of climate change, problems of pandemics just spill across the boundaries that we've created between countries. During the pandemic, I co-authored an article with former Prime Minister Gordon Brown on exactly this. That particular paper was focused more on international cooperation with respect to the pandemic, a feeling that we had just in so many different dimensions failed to rise to the occasion with respect to coordinating and cooperating across international borders. But I think many of the ideas and arguments sort of generalize to thinking about many of the other challenges that we face. We are not going to respond effectively to the challenge of AI unless we have some kind of international cooperation and agreement. We're not going to respond to the challenge of climate change unless we do that, and so on. I think the international dimension is incredibly important. It's also one of the areas that's more troubling when you look at the shape of the international community today.
Yes. And speaking of that, you serve on the Institute of Ethics and AI at Oxford.
That's right. It's a fascinating interdisciplinary community looking exactly at that, at the ethics of artificial intelligence. It's of real interest to me. I mean, I'm the only economist there, but the moral, ethical side of these technologies I've always found very fascinating. I often get asked in conversations about artificial intelligence, what can machines do and what can they not do? But far more important and far more consequential, I think, in thinking about what the kind of limits or barriers to AI are going to be in the years to come, are not these questions about what they can do, but they're more questions about what they should do. Already today, there are lots of areas of our economic lives where we could use these technologies, but we choose not to. Not from technical point of views, but from moral point of views. For instance, the use of autonomous weaponry in the military setting. You know, there are technologies we could use, but we don't. And an indeterminate question in thinking about what the impact of technology on work is going to be is, where do we draw those moral limits? What areas of our lives do we think it is inappropriate to use these technologies? For instance, in the legal profession, we have systems that help inform parole decisions today in the United States, and we might feel comfortable with that, but how would we feel about using one of these systems to make life sentencing decisions? Probably far less comfortable. We have systems that can help make medical diagnoses in medicine, and we might feel comfortable with that. But how would we feel about one of these systems making decisions to turn off life support systems in a hospital, even if they could make a more efficient decision about the allocation of finite hospital beds given the available data? So I'm very interested in these sort of moral, these normative limits to these technologies, as well as the technical and the economic.
Yes, indeed. And of course, the dangers you address there with militarized AI, but also in maybe less stark moral terms, you've written about new roles for empathizers or paraprofessionals. Yes. And, you know, so it can become cost effective. But what? How does that diminish our humanity? I mean, is there becoming so able now to AI systems and technologies and able to read emotions or at least process emotions? So what, you know, I think we're losing in the process depending on these systems.
One of the most troubling, but also one of the most fascinating, it's a sort of double-edged thing, is that these technologies are forcing us to ask the question, what does it really mean to be human? What is humanity? You know, think about a faculty like creativity. Since I began thinking about the impact of technology on work almost 15 years ago, one of the things that people have said to me time and time again is that, look, Daniel, what you're talking about is all very well, but these machines will never be able to be creative. They'll never be able to do anything original, take us by surprise, come up with something novel. And for a long time, that seemed to be true. And so many people thought the core of what it means to be a human being is to be a creative thing. With the arrival of generative AI in the last few years, I think, you know, that has been really called into question. Systems like ChatGPT, Gemini, Claude, DALL-E, Midjourney, the kind of tasks they are particularly good at doing are tasks that require creativity from us. They're particularly good at coming up with text, images, video even, something like Sora, which takes people by surprise, which is original, which is novel. And so I think one of the interesting philosophical consequences of these technologies is that it's challenging some of the complacency and some of the deep-rooted assumptions we have about what it really means to be a human being. And that is, I think, both fascinating and also quite troubling, because you can ask for any answer you give to that question. Are you really sure that in, say, 5-10 years, we're not going to have a technology that can do that as well, just as it did with creativity?
Yeah, it's very difficult. I think that it's with the different artists, and I'm an artist and writer too on the fictional level, so I have that kind of understanding. And speak.
That's right.
It's all about the personal biographical choice that I understand. I mean, that's the only thing. What in the black box, we don't know. There are biographies going into what we've all been scraped, but we just don't have that level of fine-tuning. So I guess in the end, maybe we'll all be finishers if we opt in.
Do you use, I'm interested in your role as a writer, do you use these technologies in your work? Any generative technologies?
I found it very difficult in painting. I wouldn't do that. It's a hand touch thing. And you wrote about that as well, about being able to replace touch. Would we want that? There's something that we get from that. And I find, I think that maybe if someone, if I had notes and I put something in, and maybe it just helps sort things out like that. But the thing, when you're speaking about inspiring people with language and a personal story, I think it's a little cold. For me, still, I just think it's cold. I found it interesting that there was this nonprofit, NaNoWriMo, National Novel Writing Month, that promotes creative writing, and the aim is to write a novel in a month. But the organizers had said that it was not democratic. It was a kind of elitist and ableist to say that AI shouldn't be used in writing. I just thought it was a very strange concept to put out there, that you should tell writers that it was bad to tell them not to use AI because somehow you are valorizing talent. You are valorizing the people who are able.
Yeah, I'm not sure about that. I mean, the reason I find this interesting is, you know, I write nonfiction, although I am at the moment doing a fiction project too, which I'm really enjoying actually. But the reason I asked that was because I use some of these systems to generate bedtime stories with my children, which is a lot of fun. Crafting a prompt, getting the kids to craft a good prompt, is quite kind of intellectually demanding and interesting exercise. Getting them to think about what they want from a good story, what a good story is. Why is that interesting? It's interesting because, you know, 3 years ago, if I had said, would I be using one of these systems to generate bedtime stories for my children? I think most people would have scoffed, and yet here we are.
Well, that's interesting. That's using it as a collaborative tool, which then I would hope then in the end they would say, well, that wasn't exactly the story I wanted, but let me add to that now.
Yeah. And so I think it's exactly right. And it's one of the things that I found so unsettling about the initial reactions to these technologies, particularly from lots of established educational institutions, which was to shut them down, to ban their use, to restrict them, rather than to ask, okay, well, how can we use these to reach further, to do more interesting things? These technologies now give my children a kind of storytelling capability that would have been unimaginable only a few years ago. But it also introduces new types of creativity and new craft. Crafting a good prompt is actually quite a difficult thing to do, to get it right, to get the image that you want, to get the story that you want. And the craft of choosing the right language, getting the right terminology, and thinking very precisely about what you want is actually itself a form of skill. It also goes to this point, which comes up more practically in thinking about the future of work, that many of the jobs that people will do in years to come are just very hard for us to imagine today. You can now go online and buy packages of prompts which have been pre-written and crafted by people who are very good at writing prompts for these generative systems. The idea 3 years ago that people would make a living as a kind of prompt maximizer for a generative AI system would have just been completely incomprehensible. Just like in the 1990s, the idea that people would make a living as search engine optimizers on the internet would have just seemed not simply implausible, but quite literally unimaginable. The technologies didn't exist. The terminology for thinking about how to use them wasn't present. I think we have to be open-minded to the idea that the kind of activities that people will be doing in years to come will look very different from how they look today.
And I think it's always been the case with any, whether you're using technology or not, within the arts or other creative disciplines within the sciences, that simplicity is hard. And this is what I've encountered. The simplicity with AI systems, getting the simple is actually quite difficult. You can get some vast science fiction, you can get an onslaught of so much detail, but I found simplicity hard because I don't know what it is. It's finding the essence of something. This is just my personal experience. I was trying to get a point of view that I'd already done in a painting, and I don't use the visual prompt, and I don't put in my own images. And I thought, oh, maybe you can give me an alternate angle.
Oh, interesting. Yeah.
But it gave me Dubai. You know, it gave me not something human and small, but something vast. So I think that that's always been kind of difficult. And whether it's politics or anything, or maybe in economics, is narrowing the bandwidth to find the essence that's useful going forward. And it's applicable on the human dimension.
It's interesting. I mean, there's at the moment this week, a lot of people are talking about the Ted Chiang article in The New Yorker about what is art. And his argument in short is that art is the consequence of human beings making lots and lots of choices. Mounds and mounds, choices upon choices. And there's a sense in which what you're describing is how these systems are kind of, they're making choices in the background and being opaque about how they're doing them. That to really kind of get to the essence of something, get to the core of something, you need to whittle it down through lots of man-made choices. I'm not sure about that argument, but I thought it's been quite thought-provoking this week.
Yes. And one thing that hadn't been addressed in the future of the professions, because as you wrote, you know, at an earlier stage, was the privacy, confidentiality and security.
Right.
You know, so with these increasing frequency of data breaches and concerns about AI surveillance, how do you think these professions should adapt to these challenges?
Yeah, I think it's really very important. We write in a new preface to the book. We revised the book some years later. We went back to it and looked at what we got right and what we got wrong. And just after the pandemic, we did that exercise. And one of the things we were struck by was we hadn't attracted as much priority to issues of data privacy and data security as the development and use of these technologies would prompt. I was talking actually to a community of data privacy professionals relatively recently. It was a collection of data privacy professionals from around the world. And all of them were saying the same story, which is that this is a function that had gone from being relatively important, but relatively peripheral to the kind of core decision-making of an institution, to absolutely fundamentally key. Yeah, you know, it was a kind of key part of board decision-making and corporate strategy in a way that just it wasn't, say, 10 or 15 years ago. And it was an important emphasis that we missed in that first edition.
Oh, well, you can't predict everything that would develop, of course. But, you know, talking about co-authoring with your father,
yes.
And you also reference your brother, Jamie, as well, and others in your book. So as you reflect on some of those teachers or mentors that have been especially important in your life and helped make you the writer you are today, what did they pass on? What do you pass on to your students?
One of the nice things is that my dad, his entire career has been thinking about technology and artificial intelligence. He wrote his doctorate in the 1980s on artificial intelligence and the law. So almost 40 years ago, he was already trying to build systems that could solve legal problems. So he was really part of the vanguard in thinking about artificial intelligence. And so technology, being excited about technology, being challenged by technology, being troubled by technology has been a running theme in all of our lives. And so it's why I think in part I write about the impact of technology on work and my brother writes about the impact of technology on politics. It's a sort of funny family preoccupation. The biggest thing I got from my parents with respect to my own work was just a love of books and ideas. You know, that's the most fundamental thing, loving reading. I was very lucky that my parents were very generous buying books growing up, and it was the kind of currency of family life and dinner table conversation. And so, you know, it was very, very important. I spent a lot of time teaching at the start of my career, mathematics and economics. I do less of it now, but I think one of the things was sort of enthusiasm and an excitement and an interest in the material. I've always felt like for each individual, there was a kind of path that they could take that would get them excited and interested in a particular topic or issue. It's just that that path differed from student to student, and your task was to find the particular way of thinking about problems or how to solve problems or for whatever it might be in such a way that you were able to catch their imagination. Because I think in the sorts of things that I was teaching, mathematics and economics, cultivating a kind of dogged interest, getting people really engaged and enthusiastic about problems was very important for them succeeding. The other big sort of philosophy that I had was economics as a profession has taken in the last few decades an extraordinarily sharp mathematical turn. To many people outside the field looking in, it's almost indistinguishable from some of the most kind of complex branches of mathematics. Complete contrast to how people did economics in the first half of the 20th century, or indeed in the second half. It's a completely different sort of style, gone from being a kind of literary tradition to a kind of mathematical tradition. When teaching maths and teaching economics, I suppose one of the biggest things I did with my students was to try and make sure they understood, using the sort of mathematical tools that they were using, what the sort of intuition was, what the kind of basic idea was that this mathematical equipment was helping them figure out. I always thought of mathematics as a kind of language. What's useful about it is that it's very terse, it's very concise. You're writing in symbols rather than words. And it's also useful because you can be very clear with one another about what you're disagreeing or agreeing about, because everyone has a kind of common notation and so on. But sometimes in all of this just gets lost what the core intuitive underlying idea you're trying to get at is. And so I would always ask students for every single problem that we did, you know, what's the intuition here? What does this actually tell us? Why is this interesting? Why is this useful to be doing other than the pleasure of simply doing mathematics? So that was another big part of, but it's kind of particular to teaching maths.
That's very interesting, because I think a lot of people don't sense or don't have that sense of history of economics coming out of a literary tradition. And so I wonder, beyond your readings within economics and history, you know, what are some of those touchstones, those books? I know you enjoy reading poetry that help you get in touch with the importance of storytelling and the importance of the humanities.
Yeah. When I'm writing, as I have been for the last few years, I tend to read less fiction and more poetry. So I've been rereading a lot of poetry over the last few years. I think partly the consequence of having lots of small children who make erratic and irregular and high demands on your time, you get fewer moments of long quiet where you can read a novel. Instead, you sort of get snippets of time where you can read a poem or a few poems. There's something about poetry, which is quite conducive to the kind of moments of leisure and spare time that I have at the moment. In terms of storytelling, I suppose I've always been slightly jealous of the sort of great storytellers in other branches of science outside the social sciences, particularly the great physicists who are able to tell these stories about the world and the universe. And partly it's about the kind of technical ideas, but it's also these extraordinary stories as well. And I suppose that's partly what I'm trying to do in my work, is take these relatively obscure, technical, dry, academic, difficult economic ideas and tell stories that make it far more accessible and engaging and interesting.
Yes. And in Growth, you began when you shared that passage, you shared that lovely line about the sea lying open again, you know, getting us to dream about this vast and endless sea. And talking about reconnecting with the earth and maybe a more sustainable level of growth, not an infinite one, but one of, you know, I know you're a gardener. And as you think about planting trees for future generations, what are those ways that you reconnect with the earth and the beauty and wonder of the natural world And then just in closing, as you think about the future and the kind of world we're leaving the next generation, what would you like young people to know, preserve and remember?
I have become a very, very enthusiastic gardener, a borderline obsessive. And it was sort of inevitable. I mean, my mum has been a sort of lifelong gardener. I remember from being very young, she knew the kind of RHS, Royal Horticultural Society Encyclopedia of Gardening, almost off by heart. There wasn't a flower she couldn't identify. It was completely brilliant. My father-in-law now is also a great gardener. And so I think it was always a matter of time until I became a gardener myself. It was a consequence of the lockdown. It was a consequence of all those walks that all of us did during the pandemic and just paying more attention to the natural environment and the trees and the plants and the animals on walks and then in my own garden. And now I'm completely obsessed. At the moment, I am collecting seeds. It's very fun to do with my children. So we are, as a team, the three of us collecting seeds at the moment, getting ready for next year. Lots of labeled jars and trays of seeds drying out, and we'll get planting in a few months.
Well, thank you, Daniel Suskin, for sharing that personal story of growth and for helping us understand the price and promise of economic growth and technology. By inviting us to analyze the future of work and our economic systems, we can consider ways of balancing progress with fairness and sustainability. We all live on one planet we call home. Thank you for adding your voice to One Planet Podcast and the creative process.
Such a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
The Creative Process Podcast is supported by the Jan Michalski Foundation. This interview was conducted by Mia Funk with the participation of collaborating universities and students. Associate interview producer and associate text editor on this episode was Nadia Lau. The Creative Process is produced by Mia Funk. Additional production support by Sophie Garnier. Wintertime was composed by Nicholas Anadolis and performed by the Athenian Trio. We hope you enjoy listening to this podcast. If you'd like to get involved with our creative community exhibitions, podcasts, or submit your creative works for review, just drop us a line at team@creativeprocess.info. Thanks for listening.